From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, why it was worth getting thrown out of Donald Trump's Detroit speech.
You know, you hear about moments in history where people are like, what were you doing? What did you say? And I'm so glad that some people spoke up.
Mark Lamont Hill on Flint as a prime example of state violence aimed at people who are poor and vulnerable.
The public interest has been trumped by the private good. And the consequence of that is that we often make decisions that aren't best for the people, that aren't healthiest for the citizenry. They simply are cheaper and more efficient.
And the longtime Michigan coach who helped three runners from New Zealand get to the Rio Olympics.
I am optimistic. I am always optimistic. I want all three in the finals.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up, CNN contributor Mark Lamont Hill.
Flint is an example of state violence at the worst level, without a gun or a bullet involved.
But first, Donald Trump came to Detroit to give a speech. For Michiganders opposed to Trump and what he stands for, it was their chance to speak back. Some 300 protesters gathered to chant outside Cobo Center in Detroit as Trump spoke to the Detroit Economic Club. And nearly 20 women took the protest inside, interrupting Trump and being escorted outside by Secret Service. Among those kicked out of Monday's speech, former Democratic State Representative Rashida Tlaib, who was there as part of Moms Against Trump. She's with us now. Did you go to the Trump speech planning to make some kind of statement, or was there just a particular moment that got you that fired up?
Well, when the ticket was offered, at first I said, well, I'm going to go and I'll do something, because if he says something racist, right? And I think as I watched the other young girls getting up and, you know, kind of dragged out, I then had this urge to get up, and I did. But as Moms Against Trump, I think it was important for us to be able to vocalize some of our concerns. Unfortunately, people are more focused on us being escorted out than the questions that we asked him.
And tell us exactly, what did you say that got you tossed from the speech?
I got up and yelled, please do better for our children. I said, our children deserve better. Please stop with the hatefulness. Read the Constitution. Your rhetoric is dangerous. What did you teach my son when you took the Purple Heart? Give it back. You know, it didn't earn it. And that's when I was escorted out.
Did anyone say anything to you as you were walked through the crowd, either during then or afterwards?
The audience already was saying things as some of the women were getting up and escorted out.
Like
and
what?
Why did they even come here? And, you know, oh, they're all women. And what did she say? You know, it was very hard because people would begin to boo. And then the young girl next to me, I said, you know, they're talking about sexual harassment and his stance on that. And the fact that, you know, a lot of us women worked really, really hard, and we still continue to work extremely hard to make work environment safe for us and not hostile. And, you know, sexual harassment is a real issue that's still very serious in various workplaces. Trump has continuously hinted or directly said that, oh, in some instances, it's okay, or that if it is happening, they need to find another job. You know, those are things that is coming out of his camp, from his son's mouth to himself as a candidate. You know, for me, I was there as a mom, and the fact that my kids continuously ask me about him and the anxiety that it's causing. I'm sure I'm not the only mom or parent out there that is experiencing the same thing I have. It's very easy to keep some of that away from them, but when it's so escalated to the point where, I mean, every single day he was saying things that are just really hard to explain to a child, that this person is running for president. You know, Adam continuously thinks he's trying to take over the world, like there's some sort of character, and worried about it. And so a lot of us moms, I mean, there's about 20 or so of us in Moms Against Trump, and we talk about it. We share articles about how to talk to your child about Trump. The fact of the matter is, like, the rhetoric is already there. It's already done the damage, and it's going to take years, even if he's not president. It's going to take us a while to try to address the harm that he caused our kids. I've heard many of my Latino friends tell me that their kids are talking about being deported. They're like, well, you were born here. Why are you talking about that? You know, things that they didn't expect their 6 or 7 year olds to be talking about.
I have to ask, what are your thoughts, Rashida Tlaib, about the way that some news reports described you, Muslim, Palestinian?
It was frustrating because I know that is a way to discredit me. As soon as you label me that way, my ethnicity or my faith, people shut down. They don't say, oh, this is a mom of two boys, 11-year-old and a 5-year-old. This is a mom that is raising her children Muslim in America. This is a mom that's actively involved in anti-poverty programs, all those things. But people are not talking about that. They're not talking about where does that passion, that drive come from. The fact of the matter is 13 of us went there risking getting arrested because we were passionate about women issues, passionate about having this like seat at the table without being victimized because we're female. For me, it was like, I got to do something because, you know, you hear about moments in history where people are like, what were you doing? What did you say? And I'm so glad that some people spoke up. People know that I say this a lot, and it's true, but this like Nazis type rhetoric of dividing and picking people out of the country and things of that nature. It is really, really harmful psychologically to our children. And I needed to say something and speak out, but I'm so upset that it was more, oh, you're just jumping up and down and no, but I'm glad when people do ask me what I say and I tell them. But yeah, I'm proud of being Palestinian Muslim, but my God, if anybody knows me, knows that I was there as a mom more than anything.
Was that local media, Rashida, or national media?
I mean, it was a combination. I think locally, the newspapers labeled me that way. I think as folks are out there, and what's interesting, people don't know what I am or anything, but that is now becoming, oh, the Palestinian Muslim former state rep. You know, it really minimizes our voices when people talk about us that way and trying to label us that way. I continue to be frustrated with that because I don't know if they would do that to somebody that wasn't of Muslim faith.
Rashida, what would you say right now to Donald Trump if you had him just one-on-one, the two of you standing before each other, what would you say to him?
This may sound corny, but it's true. I would beg him and say, please stop. Say positive things about people of different faiths, say positive things that would bring us together as a country, and please stop. That these little ears are listening, and that his legacy will be that he created this kind of fear and this kind of division that is going to live in our country for years, even if he isn't elected, and that he needs to step back, breathe, and remember that his words matter, to stick to values, not insults. If he does that, and I'm serious, Donald, you will be successful. You will thrive. You will grow, hopefully. In some ways, if you are not prepared to grow as you're running for president of the United States, then maybe you shouldn't be running for president of the United States because my sons deserve so much better. So behave yourself. Take a time out and try to rethink about how you're going to bring our country back together because you've divided us too much.
I have to ask, were you charged or were you just escorted out and allowed to go?
Escorted out.
Okay. Former Democratic State Representative Rashida Tlaib, who is part of Moms Against Trump. Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Rashida.
Thank you.
Donald Trump's speech before the Detroit Economic Club was billed as his chance to spell out his economic vision for America. Well, let's get a review and see whether Trump was looking back or to the future. With us, Michigan State University economist Charles Ballard. Well, Charlie, he talked about the coal industry. He talked about Detroit's crumbling factories, neighborhoods. What did you hear in Donald Trump's speech?
Well, I heard a lot of stuff that seemed to point toward the America of generations ago. In particular, there was nothing about renewable energy. He was talking about coal, so we would go back to an industry that we've been relying on less and less and that produces the dirtiest energy. There was nothing about the internet, nothing about entrepreneurship or innovation. And that was a little bit surprising to me. I thought that there was a missed opportunity for Mr. Trump to look forward a little bit more. A lot of what he said was sort of standard Republican stuff, tax cuts focused largely on high income and high wealth people, reduced regulations. But I was disappointed that there wasn't more about how could we spur productivity?
And so often you and I have talked on this program about innovation and entrepreneurism, the startups that are happening in Michigan as really looking ahead as the way of the future.
Yes, and I think it may be that part of what's going on is that the centerpiece of Mr. Trump's message is that things are really, really bad. Like, for instance, he didn't mention the fact that in the last 2 months, the American economy has added well over 500,000 jobs. He feels obligated, I guess, to paint a negative picture, and that meant that he didn't focus it on a lot of things that I think would actually help the economy to be better. In particular, I noticed that he said that Detroit was the living, breathing result of Hillary Clinton's failed policies or something to that effect. I thought what he was going to do with that was say, and look what an opportunity we have to make it better, and look at all the startups that are happening in Detroit, and look at the New Center neighborhood and some of the things that are going on along the riverfront and in other neighborhoods. But we didn't get that. There were some things that I liked, some things that I didn't like, and then there were also a lot of things that I thought were missing.
If you had the chance to offer some economic advice to Donald J. Trump, what would that be?
Well, I think he and I come from fairly different places. You know, I'm not a big fan of tax cuts at this time, partly because we're starting from a place where the federal budget deficit is already north of $500 billion a year. It's come way down from what it was back in 2010 and at the height of the Great Recession. But I do think that deficits are a problem. His original plan from last September is estimated to kick the deficit up by $10 trillion over the next 10 years. He's scaled that back a little bit. We didn't have enough specifics yesterday. I think the guess is that his new plan will come in with increasing deficits by maybe $3 trillion or $4 trillion over the next 10 years. That's still very substantial at a time when I think we are legitimately concerned about the growth in the national debt. And so I'd actually think we should go in the opposite direction and try to continue to raise enough revenue to pay our bills.
Michigan State University economist Charles Ballard. As always, it's great to get your economic insights, Charlie. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Continuing now with our week-long series looking at the state of healthcare in Michigan. It's been more than 2 years since the Healthy Michigan Plan opened the Medicaid rolls to over 600,000 low-income Michiganders. What has all of this meant for the financial health of Michigan's hospitals? Jay Green is with Crane's Detroit Business. Jay, what is the overall economic picture as we look at Michigan's 83 acute care hospitals since Healthy Michigan began in April 2014?
Yeah, well, it's been a real turnaround for Michigan hospitals, especially looking at the profit margins and the amount of uncompensated care. The last 3 years, uncompensated care has been cut in half. Charity care has dropped quite a bit because as people became insured, mostly through a Healthy Michigan Medicaid expansion, but also from the Michigan healthcare marketplace, which is the Obamacare exchange, more than 1 million people have gained either Medicaid or private health insurance. And that's cut charity care in half, cut bad debt quite a bit, although the high deductible type plans that people have been purchasing does require them to pay a little bit more out of pocket. Overall, the hospitals and the healthcare systems in Southeast Michigan and Michigan has really seen great improvements. They're hitting 4%, 5%, 8% profit margins. And just last year, which would be the second year under Healthy Michigan, Henry Ford Health System had a 300% increase in operating income. St. John had a 35%, McLaren 115%. I pretty much could go down the line.
Right.
It's been a massive turnaround, and mostly because of Healthy Michigan.
So cutting expenses and improving patient admissions, and then that big reduction in uncompensated care. Was this expected, Jay? I mean, was this on target or even better than expected?
I don't think the hospitals expected this much, although they were very much in support of Healthy Michigan and the legislature approving this back in the fall of 2013 now. Big debate. Even the small businesses were supportive of it. There was a lot of opposition, mostly along political lines, concern about federal taxes going up. But the hospitals were always in favor of it. And the biggest concern, I guess, that they had wasn't so much on the Medicaid side. It was mostly on the private insurance side. And this has been a concern because people that are mandated to purchase private health insurance, sometimes they sign up for an open enrollment, they get some treatment, and then a month or two later, they stop paying their private insurance. And that created a billing problem for some hospitals. But that's really been a minor blip. Hospitals have enjoyed almost record profits compared with the last decade anyway.
Right. So and is this pretty much around the state, Jay, or are there some areas and systems maybe doing better than others?
The biggest turnaround is in Southeast Michigan, where you've got really high levels of uninsured. And the safety net hospitals have seen the greatest improvement. You look at Henry Ford Health System. Mm-hmm. They serve downtown Detroit, their flagship hospital. St. John Hospital, located flagship in Northeast Detroit, 35% increase. So it's really the biggest turnaround is where you have the highest number of uninsured and also you've seen the greatest increase in Medicaid enrollment.
I like the way you put that, safety net hospitals. Jay, overall then, from what you hear from hospital administrators, especially in Southeast Michigan, do they believe Healthy Michigan's been a good benefit?
Absolutely. They would take care of these patients anyway. Now they're getting paid for it. And it's helping them because they have greater revenue flow. It's helping them really across the board expand their outreach programs into new neighborhoods. There was a concern also that the Michigan legislature might not pony up this year with about $150 million. And as far as I know, the legislature put that in the 2017 budget, and that covers 5% matching share. Now, the first 3 years, the federal government provided 100% funding for Healthy Michigan Medicaid. And now starting October 1st for fiscal year 2017, the state's going to have to contribute 5%. And that's going to go up to 10% over the next 3 or 4 years to 2021. And so each year, the state will have to contribute this money. If they don't, then Healthy Michigan will end. And I know the hospital administrators are lobbying very hard and are not going to give up until it's really ingrained in the whole Michigan healthcare delivery system.
You started to touch on this a little, Jay, and I want to take you a little bit deeper. Give us an idea. What do the profits mean for us as patients? Because that's what I think most people really want to know. Well, what's in it for me? The fact that XYZ hospital system has posted some impressive profit margins. What's it mean for me?
Well, we have mostly nonprofit hospitals, and they're owned within the state of Michigan by mostly community type organizations. Detroit Medical Center, of course, is owned by Tenet, a for-profit hospital. Garden City and Port Huron Hospital, now I think it's called Lake Huron Medical Center, it's owned by Prime Healthcare out of California. So the profits that those hospitals make do go out of state, yet there is a sufficient investment at Garden City, and I know obviously a Detroit Medical Center has been building and expanding quite a bit. The community hospitals, it's kept within the state of Michigan, and so profits mean that they can hire more people to expand their coverage areas, and they can renovate their facilities. That helps them improve quality care, convert semi-private rooms into private rooms, which reduces the chance of infection. I really can't say that the hospitals are safer and of higher quality because of the profits, but they are investing in capital and in people to set the stage for better quality and patient safety.
Jay Green with Crane's Detroit Business. It is always good to talk with you, Jay, and we want to thank you for being with us on Stateside.
Okay, thanks a lot, Cindy. Take care.
In the months leading up to the Rio Olympics, Ann Arbor has been a hive of training activity for a group of runners from, of all places, New Zealand. drawn to the historic University of Michigan track field for a chance to work with retired men's track and field coach Ron Warhurst. In 2008, under Ron's guidance, New Zealand runner Nick Willis won silver in Beijing. His success story inspired Julian Matthews and Hamish Carson to travel from New Zealand to Michigan, hoping to qualify for their very first Olympics. Ron's coaching has paid off. Today, Nick Willis, Julian Matthews, and Hamish Carson all fly from Detroit to Rio to run in the men's 1500 for New Zealand. 2016 Olympian Hamish Carson is here with us, as is Ron Warhurst, retired men's track and field coach for the University of Michigan. Welcome, Ron.
Thank you very much.
So good to have you both here. Ron, how many runners have actually been working with you these past months in Ann Arbor?
Three fellows that are going to the Olympics. Nick Willis, who was the original guy who came here in 2002 and stayed on, graduated from Michigan. And I think after the 2008 Olympics, he made a tour of New Zealand. And I think he influenced quite a few younger runners of just that, hey, we can do this, like Peter Snell and the fellows did. And I think Hamish and Julian were part of that crew that were motivated to say, hey, maybe we can keep going on and on. So
yes, you're talking about Julian Matthews, who's
yes.
also been training here yeah. with Hamish Carson. And then I think the fact that when your runner, Nick Willis, had that silver medal draped around his neck from the Beijing Olympics, that probably spoke pretty strongly to you,
oh,
didn't it,
definitely.
Hamish?
Definitely, yeah. We've had a great history of milers in New Zealand since Jack Lovelock in the 1936 Olympics.
Yep.
Peter Snell, of course, and John Walker. So for Nick to have that silver medal in Beijing was massive, and I think for both Julian and I, we've really, really followed in his footsteps.
So coming to Ann Arbor to work with you, and how many Olympians have you actually trained in your career, Ron? Can you remember how many?
Well, I believe eight or nine. I am not this gentleman.
Right.
He's got a coach from home who's 93 years old.
Yeah, I'm my just, Ann Arbor coach.
I'm the surrogate away from home type of guy.
Yeah, absolutely, as they've been working.
It'll be 10 after these guys go.
You're my younger coach.
I'm the younger guy.
What is it like for you? Let's just talk about seeing Nick Willis, who came as a student from New Zealand to come and run for you at the University of Michigan. What is it like to see one of your runners standing there on the Olympic block with an Olympic medal around his neck?
Well, you kind of get spoiled. I've been spoiled over the years with some really, really great, talented young men. Brian Deemer was the first one in 1984, got the bronze medal in the steeplechase in 84 Olympics, which is a surprise. And as a continuation, Nick was a surprise in 08 to everybody around the world except me. I've had a lot of success over the years coaching distance runners and most recently really good milers. It's kind of like you anticipate something good's going to happen. And then when it does happen, I was quite choked up with it. It has to do with the emotions you get wrapped up with, you know, you're sharing with the young athletes and so forth. You share a lot of their emotions and so forth because their success is kind of predicated on how you work with them and so forth. So it's a very proud moment for sure.
Hamish, what do you remember about the moment when you realized you'd qualified, you were going to Rio?
Well, it took quite a long time, really. I'd run this time in May. Julian and I had both done this race in Swarthmore. Julian had run just under the standard, and I was just over. I was 0.05 of a second off. But luckily, there's a system whereby they take the 45 best athletes. There's a drop down where the next fastest times are taken. So I was chasing that time, and then it came to a stage later on in the season where I thought, right, I've got to get into my prep now. And so I'll just hope that I'll run fast enough. And luckily I had. And so a few weeks ago I found out that, yes, I was going to the Rio Olympics. It's going to be the first time that New Zealand's had three 1500 meter runners at the Games. So pretty special.
All of them under your wing, Ron.
Yeah, I guess.
What do you think, Hamish, that you're going to take from working with your how old? 94-year-old coach?
He's turning 94 2 days before the
amazing.
The heat. Yeah,
your longtime coach in New Zealand, and then coming here with your younger coach Ron, your Ann Arbor coach Ron. What are you taking away from these months of working in Ann Arbor that has just given you something that you needed to make the Olympics?
It's just a great training environment. I mean, Nick being a silver medalist previously at the Olympics, you know that if you can keep up with him in training, that you're on the right track. And Ron's been coaching Nick for so long, so he obviously knows what he's doing as well. So I can just run along with Nick, and really it just takes a whole lot of pressure off.
Nick's like the pace car.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, he's in great form.
But did you get new insights about what you can do personally from working with Ron?
Yeah, definitely. It's just made it all go a lot smoother, I think. But because Ron's there at every session, and he's yelling at us from the sidelines, saying very nice,
using that Marine training, right, Ron?
Yeah. but also it's not just about pushing it really hard in every session. I've gained a lot from listening to both Ron and Nick about taking it easier on those days that you don't need to be pushing to the max. And so when those harder sessions do come around, I've got a bit more in the tank to really push it.
I'm interested, what do you tell your runners, Ron? You've got these young runners, you've got Hamish, first time ever going to the Olympics, along with Julian. Nick, it's his fourth time, but do you tell them, treat it like any other race, or is there going to be something that kicks in when they're waiting for the pistol to go off, realizing they're running with those five rings overhead?
To me, it's just like preparing for another race, you know, a championship race. You're tapering down. You've got all your background. You're tapering down. When you get to the line, you have to be very confident in what you're going to do. You have to have a race plan. But within the race plan, there's got to be some flexibility in case other people do things that you're not expecting. And I think that's where the confidence comes in, of the preparation of what they've done for the past 4 or 5 years up until the point now that they're confident that they've raced a lot of these people before. It's not they're going to go in there and see all these different people, possibly a few, but through the first rounds, it's going to be like, this is just another race, and the Olympic finals is what the goal is to be. So there's still 3 or 4 efforts that have to be accomplished before they get there. So I think the more confident they have and the less nerves they can deal with and control that emotion, becomes a lot simpler for them to focus on what they're doing. It's really difficult. There's so much going on, and everybody's there. Oh, you're in the Olympics, and they're going to have family there. Hamish's mom's going to be there. And, it's a fantastic thing for everybody involved. And people got to realize that the most important thing is what these guys are going to do.
It is interesting to stop and think that Hamish and Nick and Julian, who have come from New Zealand to run in Ann Arbor and work with you, they're running on a truly historic track. When you think of what happened on May 25th, 1935, remind everyone again, Ron, what did Jesse Owens do that day on this track?
On the track that they've trained on, Jesse Owens set 4 world records that day. I believe he ran the 100 in a world record, the 200, the long jump, and I believe he ran the world record in the 200 yard hurdles back in those days, all within an hour. That's what's really amazing thing about it, and we've got a plaque down there, even though he's Ohio State Buckeye, people definitely do recognize, great performance and great feats from,
and there was
no such thing
as doping around then either.
No, that was purely, he was purely on organic food at that time, and juice.
When you think what he did a year later by smacking Hitler right in the face at the Berlin Olympics and winning gold medals right under Hitler's nose.
Absolutely.
Apart from that obvious hope for a medal, Ron, what are your hopes for your runners as they head to the Olympics?
I just hope all three of them get through. I think it would be a fantastic effort if both Julian and Hamish got to the semis, and then after that, it's like it's icing on the cake. It's just a matter of, oh my gosh, they're in the semifinals. Well, Julian made the semifinals last year in the World Championships. But he was running on empty at that point because he had run like 25 races trying to get us, chasing a standard. And this is a whole lot different. They've been prepared a lot better, I think, being at altitude and doing the stronger workouts that we've done. So I am optimistic. I am always optimistic. I want all three in the finals. But, realistically, Nate's hoping to get a medal and Nick's hoping to get a medal. And I think their goal is to get to the semis and then reevaluate the goals. You can always change your goals.
Step at a time.
Yeah, you don't have to say, well, if we don't get here, it's a failure this way. You get to the prelims, then you go, okay, the next goal is to get to the next round. So you can always adjust your goals accordingly, and I think that's where I think their mentality, where their heads are at this point.
And the men's 1500 will be run on?
The 16th. And then the semifinal is on the 18th and the final on the 20th.
I do believe that NBC will cover it, even the prelims, because of several American milers or 1500-meter runners will be in there. So,
we got to scalp some of them.
I think if you look for the black jersey with the silver fern. And
we know those are Ron's guys.
Yes, ma'am. They're New Zealand's guys.
Yes, but they're yours too.
Yes.
Ron Warhurst, of course, retired as the University of Michigan men's track and field coach, still helping young athletes realize their dreams of running in the Olympics. And Hamish Carson headed to his first Olympics to compete for New Zealand in the men's 1500. Good luck to you, Hamish.
Thank you very much.
And Ron, thank you so much for sharing your coaching tips for all of us, because there's some very good ideas that you're offering out there. Thanks so much to both of you for being with us.
And thanks, we thank you also.
Listening to Stateside, I'm Cynthia Canty. It is clear America is in the grips of an opioid addiction epidemic. But here is a dilemma. What if you're in severe pain? Is there a way to get pain relief without resorting to powerful medications that can get you addicted? A new study indicates the answer could be yes through something called IMPAT. That stands for Improving Pain During Addiction Treatment. Psychologist Mark Ilgen is the lead author of this study. He's with the VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System and the University of Michigan Addiction Center. Good to have you here, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
As we talk about IMPAT and what you found in the study, I want to be clear. You were studying patients, veterans, who are in addiction recovery?
Yes, that's correct. These were individuals who were already seeking treatment for their addiction and also reported pain at the same time.
And the last people who need to have a prescription for painkillers handed back to them in light of the fact that they're trying to be in recovery.
Exactly. And it's a very challenging situation for both the treatment clinic as well as for patients to know what to do in that situation with the pain as well as this known substance use disorder.
So tell us about this pain treatment approach called IMPAT. What is it, and how does it help to control pain without drugs?
It is a psychotherapeutic approach, non-pharmacological approach, designed to help people adapt to and cope with their pain. The emphasis of the intervention is really on developing new coping strategies, new ways of thinking about pain, and a philosophy where people are actually getting out into the world and trying to try out different experiences, trying to have a more positive day-to-day experience with the hope that that will improve their perception of pain and also their quality of life.
It sounds like get busy with other things so you're not obsessing with the pain and exactly. Focusing on the pain, kind of tune it out and put it more in the background?
Exactly. That's a big part of it. There's really a close relationship between depression, physical activity, pain, and functioning, kind of how well you're getting along with others in your life and doing the things you need to do. And all those things are really intertwined. And when the focus is falling too much on pain level or how much pain someone's experiencing, understandably, that becomes a big focus of your thinking. But that can then, unfortunately, cause people to withdraw from their lives a little bit, not make the closer social connections, not really do the things that they normally enjoy doing, and then they end up more depressed and actually end up feeling more pain because it's more on their mind and more severe.
The results of your study, what did you find?
We found that the individuals who participated in the IMPAT condition or received this psychotherapy approach had lower self-reported pain, higher functioning, and less alcohol use over the course of 12 months than a group that got a comparison, what we'd call an attention-based control, but a kind of a supportive group therapy. But that didn't include what we'd think of as the active ingredients in this intervention.
And I would suspect we're talking, there's varying levels of pain. So if somebody's in excruciating pain from an injury or an illness, would you take a different approach to that versus someone in some chronic pain, knees are bad or that type of thing?
Certainly, I think that this is an intervention for chronic pain, not acute pain, and that within the group of individuals with chronic pain, there's obviously a whole myriad of conditions that someone might be experiencing. This was a group-based intervention, so we actually tried to help people identify commonalities between their experiences with pain. So someone might have back pain, someone might have migraines, and someone might have neuropathic pain, and the goal was to really foster a dialogue across people about their different experiences and their similarities and still think of what could they identify to do to kind of add more of that fulfilling side of their life and to hopefully decrease the focus on pain.
Is it complicated or expensive?
It is time-consuming and requires a bit of training. The intervention itself was designed to be delivered on top of an existing episode of addictions treatment. Addictions treatment is a modality that often involves groups and regular visits to a clinic. And so this was intended to be one of those visits that could be added on to what someone was already doing to learn how to better manage their substance use.
So going forward, Mark, could this non-drug approach to pain control wind up being something that could be used for patients, people who are not in recovery? Could it lead toward a new approach to dealing with pain?
I think that similar approaches could really have broader implementation and be adopted in a number of other settings. There's actually a psychotherapy literature on pain management strategies that stretches back 30, 40 years that shows that these types of interventions can be effective for individuals with a number of different pain conditions. I think the foundation in the literature is strong and goes beyond our specific study. What we did that was different was that almost all of those prior studies had excluded individuals with drug or alcohol problems. Mm-hmm. So they tended to view those as the most severe patients, or in some cases, not really their patients. They were focusing on the pain patients, and this complicated group didn't fit their definition well enough. What we did is focused on that other group that wouldn't have been in the prior studies and tried to see what we could do and whether what we thought might work mm-hmm. could actually help this group given the severity of their problems.
And mixing these two treatment methods together
exactly.
certainly seems to help. What do you want to do now with this?
In terms of research, we have an ongoing study that's funded by the National Institute of Health. It has already recruited close to 500 adults from a residential drug and alcohol treatment program in Waterford, Michigan, and has a similar design to this other study. So we want to look in a larger group of individuals mm-hmm. to see whether it works outside of an integrated health system like the VA, where people are getting a lot of additional care. And importantly, we wanted to see whether it would work in both men and women. There were very few women in our study. Even though we tried to over-recruit women, we were recruiting from a drug and alcohol treatment clinic in the VA, and those patients just weren't that common. We want to see in this larger study whether the effects hold and whether they seem to be similar in men and women.
Was it exciting to you and the research team to see clearly that this was making a difference for these patients?
Yes, that was a very rewarding part of the work. You know, we started thinking about doing this type of study, I'd say over 8 years ago now. And it was really before, at least I was aware of all the concerns about opioids. And it was more in response to just the knowledge that we had a lot of patients in our clinic with pain and we weren't sure what to do. This kind of storm of concern and national attention around opioids and overdose has really in some ways grown up around the study. And I think as that was happening, we became more and more interested to see, you know, could this work? And given all the challenges that these individuals face, could we make a difference? And so it was, yes, it was very exciting to see that there were some effects and that could make a difference. I would say, though, it's important to point out that the effects themselves are somewhat modest. You know, as much as we were encouraged, it's clear that there's a lot of additional work to be done. And I think there is the potential to think of other strategies to maybe supplement this approach, things like physical therapy, even meditation, yoga, other what are often called, you know, complementary approaches could maybe enhance these effects and help them maybe make deeper impacts on people's lives.
But it adds another tool to the toolkit. Mark Ilgen is a psychologist with the VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System and also the University of Michigan's Addiction Center. He's lead author of a study that's been published in the journal Addiction. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Mark Lamont Hill believes we're in the middle of a war in America, a war being waged on the vulnerable, the destitute, the struggling. So often, those vulnerable people are Black, immigrant, LGBT, poor, easily overlooked. They are nobody. Mark Lamont Hill is a journalist and political contributor to CNN and a distinguished professor of African American Studies at Morehouse College. His new book is Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, from Ferguson to Flint and beyond. Mark Lamont Hill, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
The title of your book certainly strikes a chord here in Michigan. You say Flint and the people of Flint really sum up exactly what it means to be nobody in America today. What does that mean, to be nobody?
To be nobody in America today is to be vulnerable. In a sense, just being human is to be vulnerable. Every day that you're born in this world, you're one step closer to death. So we're all vulnerable. But part of why we have governments is to reduce the vulnerability, to reduce the chance that we'll die from misfortune or disease or poor health or other things. And for the vulnerable, in some ways, the government, the protective function of the government has gotten smaller and smaller. And for others, the government actually makes them less safe rather than more safe. And that's a really scary thing. And so, you know, all across America over the last few years, we've put a bigger spotlight on state violence. We've seen a rise in police-involved shootings. We've seen people die at the hands of law enforcement. Many were unarmed. Many were mentally ill. A gross majority were black and brown. Many were male. Many were trans. Many were women. I mean, there's just a range of people who are all vulnerable. And the other piece of this is that vulnerability isn't just about state violence, and state violence isn't just about police guns and bullets. As you mentioned, Flint is an example of state violence at the worst level, without a gun or a bullet involved.
What are the most troubling aspects of Flint's story to you?
For me, first of all, the fact that an economic imperative drove the shift in water supply. You know, we live in a moment where market values drive everything that we do. The public interest has been trumped by the private good. And the consequence of that is that we often make decisions that aren't best for the people, they're not healthiest for the citizenry. They simply are cheaper and more efficient. Efficiency, which is a market value, has often trumped democracy. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that when we found just extraordinary amounts of lead in the water, when we found out that, you know, that the water was just toxic, there was almost an indifference to this reality. We ignored it. It took nearly a year to respond to this. I mean, that's stunning. And it's hard to imagine that if we were in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, as opposed to Flint, Michigan, that this would have been the reality. The EPA standards for water is about 15 parts per billion of lead. Just to get, even if you're not a scientist, just understand the number 15. You shouldn't have, that's how much lead you should have in the water. 15 parts per billion, right? In Flint, there were not 15, but 13,200 parts per billion in one sample. I mean, and at no point was it lower than 300 parts per billion. So you're talking about really an act of civic evil here. It was bizarre. And there were people who were stepping up. There were pediatricians like Mona Hanna Atisha, an Iraqi doctor who stood up and did something about this, who stood up and said something about this. And yet nothing was done. You know, that's the other part of this. You know, it's one thing to have such civic evil occur. It's another thing to ignore it.
To your point, not just ignore it, but say, no, there's no problem. I mean, just the many ways state officials and spokespeople said, hey, it's all good. In fact, Brad Werfel, who's the former spokesman for the Department of Environmental Quality, said to Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith, our reporter, and here was his quote, let me start here. Anyone who's concerned about lead in the drinking water in Flint can relax. And just weeks later, the state was admitting, oh, yeah, we do have a problem and we have to switch back to Detroit water.
And that's the scary part, right? Because, again, people rely on the state for some level of protection. Again, the role of a government is to make your life more rather than less safe. And the backdrop of this, which is also a problem, is the economic reality attached to this. You know, part of what you see is the rise of the emergency manager, right? Someone who intervenes when the state becomes financially shaky, when it becomes insolvent. And the emergency manager has a different set of governing responsibilities and a different set of accountability standards than a normal politician. So you have an emergency manager who's trying to, again, efficiently respond to a civic crisis, but they're not accountable to a voting base. They're not accountable to the public in the same way that a public official is. And so, again, the private interest, a privatized manager, a privatized approach to water, a privatized approach to governing becomes the reason why we end up where we end up. It is a stunning shift in our nation that has occurred over the last 30 years. You keep hearing lately this rise in neoliberalism, and that's exactly what we're seeing here. We're seeing the liberalization of the market. We're seeing notions of deregulation and austerity and privatization become the way that we approach civic life. And as a result, you see community fractures. You see individualism over the collective good. And you see results like Flint.
I'm speaking with historian Mark Lamont Hill. His book is Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, From Ferguson to Flint and Beyond. Mark, it's been such an angry couple of years in this nation with the police-related shootings. We just learned of the Chicago police shooting death of another unarmed young black man, 18-year-old Paul O'Neill. We see the Trump campaign and the messages that the candidate delivers and those angry reactions as the supporters leave his rallies. What do you think is going to happen in this nation with so many people expressing such anger and scorn at the nobodies? Where do you think that's going to go after the November election, whether Donald Trump should win or whether he should lose?
One thing that I'm excited about is that we finally can have an honest and transparent conversation about race and racism in America and about economic injustice in America. What the Donald Trump supporters have done for us is they've given us a spotlight and they've shown us that there is still a huge slice of American life that still holds white supremacist values, that still holds nationalist ideals, that is still deeply xenophobic, that still has anti-Muslim sentiments. And when you see all of that stuff, you know, having worked in media for a long time, I get the emails, I see this stuff, but oftentimes most Americans don't identify with it. But when you have somebody like Donald Trump who can kind of galvanize all that energy and then even put a big yellow or red hat that says Make America Great Again on top of those people, we can really see them and out them. In some ways, as scary as it is, it's comforting to know that we can now at least keep a handle on it. I think what we do now is we have to figure out how to respond to that. There is such a deep animus toward the vulnerable in this country right now, and Donald Trump's campaign is evidence of that. He didn't create it. He is the outgrowth of that. He is the monster that Frankenstein creates, as it were. He is the person who sort of becomes the representation of all of this stuff, the embodiment of all of the things that we've been fighting against on the left for a very long time. So if Donald Trump becomes president, or if he does not become president, either way, we have to fight against this moment. We have to fight against this moment of white supremacy. We have to fight against this moment of neoliberal ideology. And it's not just a national issue. It's an international issue. And the other thing that Donald Trump reminds us of when he stands on stage with Hillary Clinton, and they have fairly similar takes on education, they have fairly similar takes on the death penalty, they have fairly similar takes on the occupation of Palestine, we have to say, hey, the Democratic option is certainly better than Donald Trump. However, there is not a significant left-wing movement in America if we are comfortable with the Clinton regime as the model for left-wing politics. We have to drag everybody to the left. So we have work to do regardless of who's president. And the fact that state-sanctioned violence occurs, the fact that cities like Flint or Baltimore or Cleveland or Philadelphia can have lead in the pipes, the fact that we can continue to outsource jobs, the fact that we continue to not keep a grip on this nation when it comes to these fundamental issues is a suggestion that we all need to organize for November, but also beyond November.
Mark Lamont Hill, journalist, political contributor to CNN, a distinguished professor of African American Studies at Morehouse College. His book is Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, From Ferguson to Flint and Beyond. It was great to talk with you, Mark. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Pleasure is mine. Thank you so much.
Join us at this time tomorrow for a State of Opportunity special, Waiting for Change, Stories from America's Broken Immigration System.
I could not agree more that our immigration system is broken, and what it means to me is the people I meet and see every day whose lives are really being destroyed as they lose family members and lose a country that they love.
That's tomorrow at 3 and 10 here on Michigan Radio.